Chapter 13. At 52, Kilgallen, who broke the glass ceiling before the term was used, while balancing her various careers with motherhood, had it all: fame, fortune, and family. She was the first female media icon whose accomplishments rival those of modern-day media personalities such as Oprah Winfrey, Barbara Walters, Diane Sawyer, and Katie Couric. Now she was about to venture into the biggest case of that career while being unaware that a cover-up of what happened in Dallas was already underway. Within hours following JFK's death, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover directed his agents to have something issued so that we can convince the American public that Oswald is the real assassin. Hoover also called White House aide Walter Jenkins and told him, "The thing I am most concerned about, and so is Mr. Katzenbach, Deputy Attorney General, is having something issued so we can convince the public that Oswald is the real assassin." Hoover instructed his aide, Clyde Tolson, to prepare a memorandum to the Attorney General setting out the evidence that Oswald was responsible for the shooting that killed the president. Meanwhile, under direct orders from Robert Kennedy, Deputy Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach wrote a yellow pad memo forwarded to President Johnson's press secretary, Bill Moyers. It is important that all of the facts surrounding President Kennedy's assassination be made public in a way that will satisfy people in the United States and abroad that all of the facts have been told, and that a statement to this effect be made now. The public must be satisfied that Oswald was the assassin, that he did not have Confederates who are still at large, and the evidence is such that he would have been convicted at trial. Speculations about Oswald's motive ought to be cut off. As Kilgallen investigated without knowing about Hoover and Katzenbach's actions, Jack Ruby asked Detective Don Ray Archer if Oswald was dead. Recalling the conversation, Archer said, "Ruby's behavior to begin with was very hyper. He was sweating profusely. I could see his heart beating. He asked me for one of my cigarettes. I gave him a cigarette. Finally, after about 2 hours had elapsed, the head of the Secret Service came up, and I conferred with him, and he told me that Oswald had died. This should have shocked Ruby, because it would mean the death penalty. I returned and said, 'Jack, it looks like it's going to be the electric chair for you.' Instead of being shocked, he became calm. He quit sweating, his heart slowed down. I asked him if he wanted a cigarette, and he advised me that he didn't smoke. I was just astonished at this complete difference of behavior from what I had expected. I would say his life depended on his getting Oswald." Ruby's reaction, if Kilgallen had known about it, would have perked her interest for certain. Why, she would have wondered, had Ruby relaxed at the news Oswald was dead unless he feared repercussions from others if his mission to kill Oswald had not succeeded? And who were the others, Kilgallen might have pondered. Regardless, captivated by the national outrage over the assassinations of JFK and Oswald, and outraged herself on a personal level, Kilgallen went into full journalist mode and, on the morning of November 2nd, made plans to visit Dallas. At the same time, J. Edgar Hoover issued a memo to the Dallas Police Department, DPD. It stated that FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. should receive all DPD files. In essence, Hoover and the FBI had taken over the investigation. What is obvious is that based on whatever she learned from sources in Dallas, Kilgallen's passion for exposing the truth had made her suspicious from the beginning of what would be called the Oswald Alone theory, as adamantly touted to the public by Hoover. Her Journal American columns began to hit hard against Hoover and other government officials, beginning with one entitled, "The Oswald File Must Not Close," published just 6 days after JFK's death. At the outset, Kilgallen's strong words were aimed at President Lyndon Johnson. She wrote, "President Lyndon Johnson has been elevated so swiftly to his new high post that in one sense he has been snatched up into an ivory tower. As chief executive, he is no longer in a position to hear the voices of ordinary people talking candidly. If he could walk invisible along the streets of the nation and listen to ordinary people talking, he would realize that he must be sure that the mystery of Lee Harvey Oswald is solved and laid before the nation down to the smallest shred of evidence. Kilgallen then added, "If Oswald is President Kennedy's assassin, he is the most important prisoner the police in this country had in 100 years, and no blithe announcement in Dallas is going to satisfy the American public that the case is closed." The case is closed, is it? Well, I'd like to know how, in a big, smart town like Dallas, a man like Jack Ruby, owner of a striptease honky-tonk, can stroll in and out of police headquarters as if it was a health club at a time when a small army of law enforcers is keeping a tight security guard on Oswald. Security. What a word for it. Finally, Kilgallen wrote, "Justice is a big rug. When you pull it out from under one man, a lot of others fall too." This bold and unnerving statement signaled to anyone complicit in the assassinations that she was a threat to exposing their involvement. She knew she could be placing herself in danger, but she remained undaunted in her investigation. Kilgallen's harsh, accusing words must have agitated LBJ as well as Hoover and others she had in her crosshairs. All were now watching closely the increasing attention given by the most powerful journalist of her era to the greatest murder case of the century. In fact, in the column entitled "Still Live Topic," also released as "The Tragedy We Cannot Forget," Kilgallen continued the drumbeat to learn the truth about what happened to JFK and Oswald, writing on December 11, 1963, "What happened in Texas on November 22nd and 2 days later is extraordinary, so it is inevitable that people should continue to discuss the events, debate them, and argue about them. But even I am amazed at the sustaining interest in the assassination and its aftermath." Extolling her propensity for mixing with the rich and famous, Kilgallen then wrote of a party she attended. Stage and film director Joshua Logan, picnic, bus stop, hosted. The guests included celebrated author Truman Capote, wealthy sportsman Alfred Vanderbilt, American impresario, theatrical showman and lyricist Billy Rose, me and my shadow, and the former president of Mexico. She wrote, "As I moved from group to group, it seemed to me that there was no one who did not want to talk, for a moment or for quite a long time, about President Kennedy, Jacqueline's astonishing fortitude after his death, the killing of Lee Harvey Oswald, and the mysterious figure who shot him, Jack Ruby. One might think that this collection of sophisticates and celebrities might be tired of the topic by now, but they were not, obviously." Kilgallen's caustic columns, especially her mention of Ruby as a mysterious figure, must certainly have drawn the attention of those who had the strongest motive to assassinate JFK. Among these must have been New Orleans mafia kingpin Carlos Marcello, who, as noted, risked losing his freedom and his billion-dollar empire if evidence surfaced that he was involved in the JFK assassination. Kilgallen had a connection to Marcello, since the mobster who set up his illegal operations in New Orleans was New York crime boss Frank Costello, and the famous reporter knew him well based on statements from her hairdresser, Mark Sinclair. In one of his videotaped interviews, Sinclair stated, "At a little Italian restaurant in Little Italy, we went down there one night, and Costello was there, and he bought us drinks and was very nice to us. She later told me who he was. I did not know who he was. Maybe we were just there to see him. I'm sure Mr. Costello gave her information, but she would never tell me that he did. She knew organized crime figures. She knew a lot of them." Adding proof to the strong friendship with Costello, Sinclair added, "He gave her a diamond cross, and she said, 'I can't wear it since it is so huge,' and so we broke it up and made it into earrings. She wore them a lot." While focusing on Kilgallen's social life, in part 13 of the New York Post 10-part series about her, another clue as to her relationship with Costello surfaced. The writers noted, "A couple of years ago, Kilgallen and a few of her male friends had what they like to call the Weekly Science Club. It meets every Monday afternoon in a reserved alcove of a well-known Third Avenue bar for the avowed purpose of discussing new ideas and driving away the Monday blues. The article then named a few of the regulars, including Bob Bach, Kilgallen's friend and a What's My Line associate producer, the same man she had drinks with at P.J. Clark's the last night of her life. In the series about the famous reporter, the writers revealed that each of the charter members, Kilgallen, Bob Bach, Bill Harbach, advertising executive Jim Downey, liquor salesman Lou Stockland, and interior decorator Howard Rothberg, could bring a mystery guest to the bar, P.J. Clark's, from time to time. The next sentence read, Dorothy had brought along Tony Perkins, Psycho, Sugar Ray Robinson, famous boxer, and Frank Costello, among others. Author's note, this must be the same science club mentioned in the FBI's 1959 memorandum detailing how a female bureau informant had infiltrated the club. The science club normally met from shortly after lunch until late in the afternoon at what was described as a large oval table. Apparently, Kilgallen wandered from time to time to the jukebox, where she played a favorite tune of hers, Little Girl Blue, which became quite popular when Doris Day sang it in the movie Jumbo in 1962. During this time, Johnny Ray would often appear and sit next to Kilgallen. Her husband Richard did not visit the group. At the Science Club, Costello may have played one of Kilgallen's favorite games called I Never, where a selected player reveals an experience he or she has never had and collects 10 cents from anyone who has had the experience. Apparently, Kilgallen, the Post revealed, once had won 20 cents on the basis of never having learned to swim or drive a car. Singer Paul Anka, although apparently never invited to the club, said of Costello, "He was something. Very tough-looking guy, heavy-set, bulldogish face with greased back hair and a big cigar. He was the epitome of that whole mafia thing. Everyone was scared shitless of him." Whether Kilgallen knew of Frank Costello's friendship with J. Edgar Hoover is debatable, but since she had the most credible sources among fellow reporters, it's safe to say she knew Hoover was soft on the mafia to the extent, early on, of disavowing that it even existed. She likely also knew that Hoover had been photographed at a staged party of gay men in Chicago by underworld figures. Apparently, Hoover was made aware of these photos by agents of the mafia, who likely also spread the hint of Hoover's homosexuality by referring to him as Miss Hoover. Costello's relationship with Hoover, however, was based on the FBI director's passion for gambling and his consistent bad luck while doing so. Hoover preferred horse racing, and according to Gianni Russo, the underling of Costello's, the Mafia Don handled Hoover's account personally and, in fact, never demanded Hoover's money for losses while paying him when he won. This was designed, Russo explained, so that Hoover was locked into compliance so as to cooperate with the mob. Before Jack Ruby's trial for killing Oswald had begun in March 1964, Kilgallen, an eyewitness to history, had launched another barrage of columns at those in charge of investigating JFK and Oswald's assassinations. In a biting Journal American column of February 21, 1964, she noted the government's refusal to provide the Ruby defense team documents they had requested. She wrote, "Say that again, slowly. Information concerning Oswald's assassination of the president will not be available." Perhaps it is dramatizing to say that there is an Orwellian note in that line, but it does make you think, doesn't it? It appears that Washington knows or suspects something about Lee Harvey Oswald that it does not want Dallas and the rest of the world to know or suspect. Lee Harvey Oswald has passed on not only to his shuddery reward, but to the mysterious realm of classified persons whose whole story is known only to a few government agents. Why is Oswald being kept in the shadows, as dim a figure as they can make him, while the defense tries to rescue his alleged killer with the help of information from the FBI? Who is Oswald, anyway? While it is easy to brush by the last paragraph Kilgallen wrote, one must examine the wording quite carefully, since it is important to understand exactly the message being conveyed. In essence, and without any doubt, the dedicated reporter is throwing questions out that should have been red flags at the time. Why is Oswald being kept in the shadows? And then, as dim a figure as they can make him, followed by, who is Oswald anyway? Anyone paying close attention would have dug deeper into the importance of Kilgallen's inquiries to find answers, but no one was paying attention. No one apparently followed up on valid issues about the man Hoover and Company claimed was the lone gunman. If they had, then it is likely the investigation of who killed JFK and why may have taken a completely different turn. On February 24, 1964, Kilgallen, privy to inside information through her close relationships with Belly and attorney Joe Tannehill, provided Journal American readers with a preview of the Ruby trial. In a column entitled, DA to Link Ruby to Oswald, she wrote, among those who know the seamier side of Dallas show business, the betting is 10-1 that District Attorney Hank Wade will produce witnesses who will testify that Jack Ruby and Lee Harvey Oswald were acquainted. Ruby has said repeatedly that he knew the alleged assassin of President Kennedy, but then Ruby's plea is temporary insanity, and there are a great many things he doesn't remember and isn't about to. Kilgallen's mention of Ruby having a great many things he doesn't remember and isn't about to appears to indicate that she saw Belly's insanity strategy as pure bunk. Since she was so close to Belly, she must have surmised that there were ulterior motives for such a defense. This would have triggered more interest on her part for the chance every other reporter attending the trial hoped for, an opportunity to talk to Oswald's killer. Unlike them, she would get that chance 3 times. Kilgallen, having referred to Oswald as an alleged assassin, then added, to quote one observer, the operation of Jack's Carousel Club had its unsavory aspects, but if Oswald checked in there a couple of nights a week, he could have made some extra money. That would account for his ability to take trips, like the one to Mexico, on a $50 a week salary. And it also would account for his lying in a room in the heart of Dallas 5 nights a week and joining his wife and children in the suburbs only on Fridays and Saturdays. The day before, the revered reporter had published a column called Nervous Ruby Feels Breaking Point Near. The first paragraph read, Jack Ruby's eyes were as shiny, brown and white bright as the glass eyes of a doll. He tried to smile, but his smile was a failure. When we shook hands, his hand trembled in mine ever so slightly, like the heartbeat of a bird. Continuing, the article stated, I'm nervous and worried, he told me. I feel I'm on the verge of something I don't understand, the breaking point, maybe. When Kilgallen told Ruby, I think you're holding up pretty well, he replied, I'm fooling you, Dorothy. I'm really scared. To explain how her interview with Ruby had begun during a trial recess, Kilgallen wrote, I had stayed behind because I had been told that Ruby would like to talk to me. In a short while, co-counsel Joe Tannehill beckoned to me, and I went up to the defense table. Jack would like to talk to you, he said. Jack rose politely to shake hands, his eyes glistening and his mouth smiling, but the total effect inexpressively sad. It's wonderful to see you, Dorothy, were his first words. She ended the article by writing, I went out into the almost empty lunchroom corridor wondering what I really believed about this man. One television interview with Kilgallen, among many, took place in Dealey Plaza, proving she had visited the JFK crime scene. Her doing so, for whatever reason, has never been reported until now. Without question, Kilgallen was the star of the show. Joe Brown, the judge, even asked for her autograph. On the very first day of the Ruby trial, Kilgallen had been frisked like everyone else attending. A photo captures that moment, destroying forever accounts by so-called experts and authors who wrote and spoke about her never even having been there. Without hesitation, Kilgallen, who wrote a column about being frisked, peered at Oswald's killer from her front row seat. As the most famous of the reporters covering the trial, she shared the spotlight with the man on trial for a cold-blooded murder witnessed by millions on live television. Regarding being frisked, Kilgallen wrote, in part, "The first morning I arrived, I was frisked 3 times before I finally got to the courtroom. Those of the gentler sex are given the treatment from 3 ladies, all with magnolia accents, who wear bright-colored dresses, pearls, and perfume. While other journalists hit the local bars or enjoyed a hearty meal at a nearby trendy restaurant, Kilgallen retreated to her overheated room at the Statler Hilton, the same hotel housing Belly, where she typed, typed, typed on her trusty Underwood typewriter. The article, entitled Ruby Stars at Last, was then forwarded to the offices of the New York Journal-American, where her prolific words would splash across the front pages of newspapers throughout the country the next day through the vaunted Hearst Syndicate. As always, Kilgallen demonstrated her unmatched skills as a wordsmith. The Carl Sandburgs of the future will spend whole lifetimes trying to analyze the drama of this week and this scene. They will never be able to appreciate the unparalleled irony that exists today in this proud and gracious city. What it all boils down to, after the assassination of a president, the slaying of a policeman, and the killing of a man nobody really knew, is little Jack Ruby. The hustler in the black suit and the very white shirt, neat and nervous, is the star of the show at last. If he died tomorrow, and he won't, he would die happy in the knowledge that he had made the big time. All the sweating that is being done in the apple-green courtroom with the lazy apple-green ceiling fans is being done over him. The long crowded row of brilliant, persuasive, charming, deceptive, tough, and realistic lawyers is split down the middle over Jack Ruby's fate. As Kilgallen watched, Judge Joe Brown, Jr., his hazel eyes hidden behind black horn-rimmed glasses, had apparently caught her attention. She added, "The judge takes off his glasses and mops his brow with a powder-blue handkerchief after a difficult legal decision. The long wooden church pews are filled with hot and restless reporters straining to catch every word from a prospective juror that might affect Jack Ruby favorably or adversely." Describing the scene with dramatics in a manner only Kilgallen could have imagined, she provided a visual that propelled readers directly into the courtroom. The corridors of the courthouse are clogged with guards, television cameras, deputies, newspaper photographers, sheriffs, bailiffs, foreign correspondents, visiting lawyers, judges from other floors, well-dressed, soft-voiced ladies who haven't enough pull to get into the courtroom but are content to sit on benches or lean on walls outside and watch the action. Continuing, Kilgallen wrote, "The action revolves around Ruby. Ruby, the strip club owner, Ruby, the natty, runty booze seller who scared the unfortunate girl dancers who peeled for his customers but could be charming and jovial when a cop came into his place," before adding, "his own lawyers, a formidable battery headed by Melvin Belly, a genius in any courtroom, have documented more than 100 incidences in which he demonstrated erratic and frightening behavior long before November 24, 1963, the day on which he strode past television cameras to kill Lee Harvey Oswald and give birth to more confusion and shame and mystery than any other man has ever created with a single bullet." Edging into Ruby's mental state, the critical aspect of the trial Kilgallen was most curious about, she observed, "Perhaps Jack Ruby's brain is damaged, as his defense claims. Perhaps he killed Oswald during a period of episodic dysfunction, as his lawyers will tell the eventual inevitable jury. Perhaps all killers are in a rage state, another predictable defense term, when they pull the trigger or stab the heart. But in court, Ruby is functioning pretty well. He is zingy, a Texas term for jittery, and inclined to worry over small problems far removed from the main peril, which is the death penalty. Continuing to focus on Ruby, whom Kilgallen believed was the real key to solving the JFK assassination, the greatest murder mystery in American history, she observed, "Yet little more than an hour later, the defendant bounced back quietly into the courtroom, lightly, like a dancer under clumsy guard. I was standing by the bar railing as he turned to take his seat, and he broke into a quick smile, gave me a friendly, bird-like nod, and said, 'Hello,' brightly. Then everything quieted down, and as Judge Joe B. Brown returned to the bench, Jack Ruby became just a head in the crowd up front, a bald pate shadowed by a few pen strokes of black hair." Kilgallen's final thoughts were most revealing, providing insight into why she knew the Ruby trial would be a turning point in American history. She informed readers, "It was sickening that the trial was taking place because of a visit to Dallas by a tall and brilliant and graceful young man named John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And now John Kennedy is dead, and all that is left to Dallas and to history is Jack Ruby." Unfortunately for history's sake, this column, an introspective into Ruby in the context of the JFK assassination, was never taken seriously at the time. It was ignored, never published in any book about the assassinations until 2018 in Denial of Justice. An unfortunate loss, since the article proved Kilgallen intended to provide the world with a first-hand account of the Jack Ruby trial as only a reporter of her caliber could do. Based on a connection to Jack Ruby through an opera friend in San Francisco, Kilgallen, one of the more than 400 reporters covering the case, was permitted the only two interviews Ruby allowed at his trial. Joe Tannehill, in an interview posted at thedorothykilgallenstory.org, stated in part, "She told me she had had a contact with a friend of Jack's from San Francisco. I believe it was an opera singer that she was very fond of. She wanted to pass a message along to him. I told Jack that, and he said, 'I'd like to talk to Kilgallen.'" Asked why Ruby had decided to speak to Kilgallen, Tannehill said, "I don't think there was any doubt about it. Jack was highly impressed with Dorothy Kilgallen, and he figured she was a very classy person, she had good programs, what's my line, and she was a highly intelligent person, and I think of all the writers that were down there during the Ruby trial, about 400 from all over the world, she probably was the one that, to him, was the most significant, 'cause he was in the entertainment business." Tannehill added, "Jack had a bodyguard shield around him of four deputy sheriffs sitting behind him and everywhere he went, and I told them Kilgallen wanted to ask him some questions and speak with him at recess, and that he'd agreed to it. And they said, 'Okay.' So when the judge declared the noon recess, Jack went over and spoke with her, in the courtroom right behind his chair where he was sitting. There was a rail there, and he got up, and she was on the other side of the rail, and Jack was on this side, and they had a little conversation. I think the press had already left the courtroom. Jack wasn't uttering nonsense, because this interview with her was very significant in his classless life, you know, and I think he enjoyed it very much and cooperated with Kilgallen in every way that he could and told her the truth as he understood it. And it was just a very agreeable conversation between them, and I just can't understand people doubting the sincerity of that interview, because to me, and I watched them, a very sincere discussion was going back and forth." Later, Tannehill wrote, "The trial was traumatic, explosive, and loaded with pressure situations in a hostile venue. We learned that Ruby often watched What's My Line on his Carousel Club TV set. He insisted on absolute privacy and a quiet atmosphere when listening to his favorite Kilgallen episode. and I was present when Kilgallen interviewed Ruby during a noon recess in the courtroom. I arranged for the prison guards to delay taking Ruby back to his cell in order that she could get the interview. Just as Marilyn's becoming involved with the Kennedys would end her life at the tender age of 36, Kilgallen's intersection with Jack Ruby would portend of evil things to come in 1965, when what she knew, based on their conversations and her subsequent investigation, made her a danger to those in power. From the start of the trial, Kilgallen, based on her interaction with Melvin Belly and her keen observations as an experienced reporter of criminal cases, had entertained doubts about Ruby's attorney, a civil lawyer not experienced in criminal matters, especially death penalty cases. She wondered whether Belly was acting in his client's best interest when he told a reporter, "Ruby is an intense, emotional man. Talking to him, the hair rose on the hackles of my neck. I felt horror, revulsion, sadness. I saw myself and millions of fellow Americans." She found it puzzling when, during the trial, he kept mixing up Ruby's name with Oswald's, especially when he questioned Dallas psychologist Dr. Roy Schaefer. Since she had buddied up to Belly, it was logical that Kilgallen would appear with him during his news conferences. One such situation resulted in her asking him about jury selection. The audio tape exchange may be heard at thedorothykilgallenstory.org. Belly was certainly mob-approved by the underworld. Former Belly legal associate John D. O'Connor told this author, "Mel was tight with Mickey Cohen and talked about him all the time. He certainly was one with connections to the underworld, and my understanding was that he was approved as okay by the mob." Seymour Ellison, the former partner who accompanied Belly to Las Vegas on several occasions, told this author, "Mel loved the mob and they loved him." Another Belly associate who wishes to remain anonymous said to this author, "Mel was intoxicated with the mafia. He loved the power, the money, the irreverence they had for authority, just like he did." Such characterizations parallel those advanced about Melvin Belly by John Christian, co-author, along with former FBI agent Bill Turner, of The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. During an interview with this author, Christian said, "Listen, Mel would say anything for money, do anything for money. He had very little integrity." Doubtless a mafia wannabe, Belly emulated those he admired in the underworld to the extent of his becoming a sycophantic cartoon character. To accentuate the success he was enjoying in the legal arena and promote his jet-set lifestyle, Belly had acquired a wardrobe next to none. "I had tailors doing variations on the standard lawyer's charcoal gray," he recalled. "They made me suits with a slightly rakish western cut, all the jackets lined in red silk, high slash pockets on the trousers, no pleats, and spare all the way down to my boots, which were not Texas cowboy boots but Congress gaiters, calf-high black boots molded from a plaster cast of my foot by Peels of London. Sometimes I wore a black Homburg." Belly also commissioned an office decor like no other in the world. When a tourist gazed through the windows, they witnessed a scene, one writer described, as out of the lair of Dickens, a gallimaufry of exotica. The office featured, among other valuables, an enormous Bengal tiger skin rug purchased for $5,000 from Elizabeth Taylor, Nepalese tapestries, a case of aged burgundy, a huge fireplace, quill pens, antimacassars, oil paintings, an array of apothecary jars, thousands of rare books encased in floor-to-ceiling mahogany bookshelves, a window seat, and a huge bar, although Belly was not much of a drinker. Kilgallen did not know that Belly, who wrote 60-plus books during his lifetime, including Modern Trials, a necessary reference for any competent trial lawyer even today, sometimes visited a bar close to the courthouse with chauffeur and friend Milton Hunt. On one occasion, in a low tone, Belly startled Hunt by confessing, as Hunt told this author, The Ruby case is fixed. I'm just going through the motions. It's simply being staged for the sake of publicity. Belly, according to Hunt, added that there's an inside thing and no way to win. It's a whitewash. Troubled by Belly's admissions, Hunt wondered whether he should pass them along to the court, to Jack Ruby, or to the Ruby family. He did not do so. Ruby prosecutor Bill Alexander was certainly troubled by his adversary Belly's actions at trial. He told this author, "It was like all or nothing, acquittal or first-degree murder death penalty. He gave the jury no in-between. I was also shocked that Belly never even pleaded for Ruby's life during his final argument, which meant that Ruby was going to get the chair. I kind of felt sorry for Ruby. Belly took a good 5-year murder without malice case and made it into a death penalty for his client." Alexander explained that Belly should have simply thrown Ruby on the court's mercy. After all, the prosecutor said, Ruby had shot the most hated man in the world. This was the same Alexander who admitted to this author that he carried a small Belgian Browning 38 pistol, one he had to discard after Belly co-counsel Joe Tannehill objected to it during a court hearing. Alexander said he purchased the gun for protection after a convicted murderer, recently released from prison, threatened to kill him. The prosecutor told this author, "I found him in a diner, jerked him off his stool, pointed the 38 at his nose, and told him if he ever came near me, I would kill him." Regardless, does this mean Belly had sold his soul when he defended Jack Ruby? Only the man whose client list through the years included such luminaries as actors Errol Flynn, Lana Turner, and Mae West, boxers George Foreman and Muhammad Ali, the Rolling Stones, evangelists Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, comedian Lenny Bruce, Washington socialite Martha Mitchell, mobster Mickey Cohen, stuntman Evel Knievel, and stripper Carol Doda knew the truth. Indicating his lack of knowledge of the music scene, when he was first told about the Rolling Stones needing his representation, Belly asked, "Now just who is this Michael Jagger guy?" Despite his famous group of clients, and even his representation of Jack Ruby, some remember Belly for a television appearance in 1968 that had nothing to do with his law practice. Belly enlisted his 9-year-old son Caesar to star with him in the October 11, 1968 episode of the television program Star Trek. It was episode 60, and the publicity release for End the Children Shall Lead read, "An evil superbeing disguised as Friendly Angel has taken over Triacus and persuaded the children to kill all the adults. Only the crew of the Enterprise can stop him from invading the galaxy. Friendly Angel is played by Belly. Caesar plays carrot-topped kid Steve O'Connell." Notorious for his loquacious nature, Melvin Belly also became involved in the case of the infamous Zodiac Killer spree in San Francisco. In this case, memorialized in the film Zodiac, where Belly is played by actor Brian Cox, police accused him of keeping vital evidence from them that could have led to an arrest, a clear indication of Belly's lack of ethics. Similarly, Belly exhibited a distinct lack of ethics in the Ruby case. Belly's associate Kent Russell told this author, "I pumped him up about it because I sensed something was wrong with his representation, but he wouldn't give any thought or consideration to a conspiracy. He just kept saying how bad Dallas was. He just totally shut the door about Ruby. He didn't want to go there. I never quite understood that." How Belly had become Ruby's lawyer remains a mystery in and of itself. Several more qualified attorneys were available, including local Dallas lawyer Tom Howard. But all at once, Belly appeared, and that was that. Explanations as to how this happened vary from one account, where Earl Ruby states that, after hearing of Belly, he flew to California to see him in action during a murder trial, a claim that was never proven, and another account where Earl Ruby states that he heard about Belly from Los Angeles journalist Billy Woodfield, who knew of Belly from Michael Shore of Reprise Records, owned by Frank Sinatra. Neither account appeared as viable as that of Belly associate Seymour Ellison, who told this author, "The phone call came from someone connected with what I would call the gaming industry in Las Vegas, the mob." Certainly, Belly's view of FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover mirrored the FBI's opinion of the bombastic lawyer. In an FBI memo secured under the Freedom of Information Act, there is this quote from Agent C.D. DeLoach. "Melvin Belly is obviously a mentally disturbed and intemperate attorney who served as defense counsel for Jack Ruby." Regarding Belly's view of Hoover, in the same memo he was quoted as having said, "The FBI director is a factious dictator who has assembled a platoon of stormtroopers. He is a dangerous man whom we should have gotten rid of a long time ago." Kilgallen knew about Belly and his client and friend, Mickey Cohen. She had included Cohen in a September 26, 1958 Voice of Broadway column, writing, "Mickey Cohen, the California gangster, is about to tour the nation lecturing on one of his favorite topics, corruption in politics." Regarding Cohen, RFK, citing Our Investigation, wrote about the infamous mobster in his 1960 best-selling book, The Enemy Within, noting that, "Hoodlums like Cohen living reputable lives in Los Angeles have major vice and gambling holdings in the Midwest. They seek to corrupt and do corrupt public officials to an alarming extent." RFK also accused Cohen of tax evasion, noting he reported income of only $1,200 in 1956 and $1,500 the next year, with the explanation by Cohen that his lavish lifestyle, $275 for silk lounging pajamas, $25,000 for a specially built bulletproof car, and at one time 300 different suits, 1,500 pairs of socks, and 60 pairs of $60 shoes, stemmed from loans from friends. Having RFK single Cohen out for special mention in The Enemy Within to the extent of disclosing what the mobster spent on pajamas must have been a personal affront, an embarrassment to the L.A. Don. Mickey Cohen's link to New Orleans Mafia Don Carlos Marcello was unchallenged. In his autobiography, In My Own Words, Cohen wrote, "Marcello is a beautiful person, a real gentleman who would break his nuts to do good for you or anyone he feels is right." No wonder, since within hours of Cohen's release from prison in early January 1972, after the gangster served 10.5 years of a 15-year income tax evasion sentence, it was disclosed that Cohen, in ill health but able to celebrate with others at a release party, visited several mineral baths in Hot Springs, Arkansas. According to a 1959 FBI file, Cohen called Carlos Marcello in New Orleans from Hot Springs and planned to see Marcello in New Orleans before returning to Los Angeles. A later entry related, "Cohen, in the company of an unknown individual, visited the office of Carlos Marcello, New Orleans LCN, La Cosa Nostra, boss, and spent approximately an hour with Marcello." Marcello reportedly gave the subject $3,000 in cash, more than $18,000 in today's currency, which, according to the source, was not a loan. Cohen and Marcello had crossed paths in 1959 during the McClellan congressional hearings when the committee investigating organized crime subpoenaed both men. A photograph depicts a dour-faced Cohen sitting across from the equally dour-faced racketeer Marcello, who is wearing sunglasses. The inquisitor for the committee was Robert Kennedy, of whom Cohen wrote in his book, "Senator McClellan only opened his mouth a very few times, but Bobby Kennedy, this snotty little guy, questioned like an out-and-out punk. If you really want to get down to it, he didn't know his ass from a hole in the ground." By all accounts, Cohen and RFK became bitter adversaries during the hearings. After Bobby kept badgering Cohen about his decision to take the Fifth Amendment and not testify, and whether a gentleman, which Cohen claimed to be, would do such a thing, he asked the suspected mobster, "What's the meaning in the underworld or the racket world when somebody's lights are to be put out?" A smirk on his face while butchering the English language with nearly every breath, Cohen replied, "Look it, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not an electrician." He then wrote, "Boy, he, RFK, got hot as a pistol. He starts to come down off the podium where he was sitting with all them senators." Cohen wrote that McClellan grabbed Kennedy before he could do so. If he had come down there, there would have been a real hey Rube in that joint. I would have torn him apart, kicked his F head in. Author Terry Tariba wrote that RFK's near attack of Cohen was because Kennedy could not countenance being derided by a contemptuous California mobster. By the time the hearings were over, Bobby Kennedy had become a national figure. He had also created a personal enemies list: Jimmy Hoffa, Carlos Marcello, and Mickey Cohen. Later, Cohen said RFK was responsible for the mobster's income tax evasion charges. Actually, Cohen was convicted twice. The first time, he was transported to McNeil Island, where he spent, as Cohen bragged, 3 years, 8 months, and 16 days. The second imprisonment was more prohibitive. He served 10 years of a 15-year sentence, the majority at Alcatraz. Cohen alleged The Rock, America's Devil's Island, which he dubbed a crumbling dungeon, was only for personal enemies of Bobby Kennedy. When Alcatraz closed, Cohen, the leader of what jokingly was referred to as the Mickey Mouse Mafia, worked in the same electrical shop at the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary earlier inhabited by mob boss Vito Genovese. When an unstable inmate named Estes McDonald bludgeoned Cohen's head with a 3-foot lead conduit pipe on August 14, 1963, Melvin Belly was summoned. He represented his friend in a lawsuit against the federal government for $10 million, winning a $110,000 judgment. Tax authorities promptly confiscated the bounty, which Belly wrote in My Life on Trial included my fee, claiming it was due for back taxes. Apparently, Cohen served as a hero of sorts for Jack Ruby, someone Ruby wanted to emulate, according to the Dallas Morning News. Dean Jennings, who was the American Guild of Variety Artists, AGVA, branch manager in Dallas in 1956 and 1957, said Ruby was somewhat of a tough guy who often appeared to be acting out a junior version of Mickey Cohen. Continuing her prowl for the truth, Kilgallen focused on Dallas Police Department, DPD, Chief Jesse Curry, and garnered an exclusive interview. He told her that his first instinct after JFK was shot was to send officers not to the Book Depository building, but to the Dealey Plaza overpass. This account is confirmed in Curry's autobiography, JFK Assassination File. An FBI document secured from the National Archives indicates J. Edgar Hoover was certainly monitoring Kilgallen's movements, since he twice wrote in longhand across a copy of the article she wrote about Curry's admission, "Wrong, wrong." Based on what Kilgallen had learned through her investigation, especially regarding the DPD being sent to the overpass by Dealey Plaza rather than the Book Depository, and her observations of Ruby during the first days of his trial, she wrote a column questioning whether the insanity defense made sense. Unlike any of the other 400 reporters at the trial, she was focusing on Ruby, not Oswald, as the key to learning the truth about the JFK assassination. Why did Kilgallen believe there was definitely a plot to kill the president? That the Oswald alone theory was pure nonsense? Because she had watched and listened to shocking trial testimony from eyewitnesses sworn to tell that truth that included an extensive chronicle of Ruby's actions before, during, and after JFK's assassination. Actions in complete conflict with the information he had provided to police.